Justice by any means necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Now a little bit about Michaela and Evelyn, our presenters. Evelyn and Michaela are community organizers in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and are members of the Red Pine Revolutionary Collective and bottomliners of Movement School, which has been an ongoing project since late 2020. Evelyn and Michaela became radical organizers through, among other things, the movement to stop the Line 3 pipeline in northern Minnesota, and have carried their learnings from that fight forward into labor, political education, and solidarity economy organizing. As I mentioned, I'm a recent completer of Movement School, and these two, I can say, did a really wonderful job putting together a pretty rad curriculum. So I'll leave it over to you to start explaining what this program is and how it came to be.
Sick. Thank you so much, Rachel. Hi, everyone. My name is Evelyn Majid. I use she, her pronouns. Like Rachel said, here from Minneapolis, but I grew up not too far from here in Evanston, which is not Chicago, as folks will remind you. And we're here from the Red Pine Revolutionary Collective, here to talk about our political education program for our revolutionary cadre. So to just give a brief overview that will hopefully be brief about who we are and what we do and why you might want to be in this session, and once I'm done with the summary, if you're like, that doesn't make sense for me, feel free to leave. It won't hurt our feelings, but I do hope you stay. Let's talk about all of those things, and I'll start with what Red Pine is. So the Red Pine Revolutionary Collective, formerly Cooperation Northfield, is a community of young radical organizers. Our projects and our organizations are based on Dakota land in Minneapolis and Northfield, Minnesota. If you haven't heard of it, Northfield is a small college town about 45 minutes south of the Twin Cities. Our flagship work includes a permaculture farm worker cooperative that also serves as a campus for our popular education programs, more on that later, a compost collection worker co-op, a left-oriented housing co-op, union organizing as union staffs and salts in restaurants, cafeterias, Amazon warehouses, Starbucks, and more, the Minneapolis Young Workers Caucus, a labor solidarity group for young radicals, a whole ton of previous work in the movement to stop Line 3, doing direct action and turnout for the front lines, childcare for organizing workers in picket lines, student organizing for climate and labor justice across two college campuses in Northfield, Minnesota, and a summer intensive and monthly social movement school program, which involves training and political education primarily for our revolutionary cadre. We're best described as non-sectarian left revolutionaries. We are anarchists, communists, and socialists, and yet unlabeled left revolutionaries brought together under a single roof. The point of Red Pine is to be a useful political home with comrades to build base and institutional power and to guide real praxis towards revolutionary ruptures. Our cadre is racially diverse, but we're majority white, majority queer, working class, women and non-binary folks. Our youngest member is 18, our oldest member is in their late 30s. Most of us are in our early 20s. Just as a general demographic overview of who we are, right? This is not the political education program, this is our political education program and what we do for our base and what we feel is relevant for those folks, right? So we wanna offer some context about how tools that we've gained over the past 3 years of doing a program like this and how it might benefit you folks in developing political education for your communities. So in more depth, what is Movement School? Movement School is a political training and praxis development program for young radicals based in central and southern Minnesota. Our pedagogical theory comes directly from Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. We do education for the sake of praxis, and praxis is the continuous cycle of theory, action, and reflection. To that end, during each summer, participants and facilitators meet twice a week, spending one day engaging together in content and discussion around the ecological, economic, and social roots of today's injustices, paired with trainings on organizing strategy, tactics, and practical skills for a lifetime of revolutionary work, and spend the other day of the week working on material projects towards systems change that they will continue to work on after the program ends, right? We don't do political education for the sake of political education. We do political education for the sake of praxis in our specific geography and in our specific communities. Some examples of content sessions that we facilitated this summer, and we're going to start passing out our curriculum arc for this summer, so you can kind of read along and look at some of those examples. Some of those include developing a theory of change, mapping revolution backwards, building effective teams, and analyses of oppression on a variety of levels. Projects that participants engaged with this summer include labor organizing on college campuses, a radical mental health collective, tenant organizing in South Minneapolis, and developing a food delivery worker cooperative. This summer, our program was split into two phases. The first 3.5 weeks were devoted purely to political education, where participants met for about 4 hours twice a week on Tuesdays and Fridays and engaged in content that comes from the Red Pine Revolutionary Collective's shared theoretical basis for why the world is so fucked. And then in phase two, we took a break and folks committed to these projects, right? We had all of our participants engage in a project. We set some pretty clear boundaries that participant is contingent on participating in a project. We believe in participatory design. That means that the questions that our participants have guide our content. What matters to them is crucial to us as we collaborate with these new comrades to build a bedrock for their future organizing. On a logistics level, Movement School is bottom-lined by 6 members of our cadre. We meet for about 2 hours every week of the year, and a lot of us do work beyond that to develop the program outside of those meetings. And it is also made possible by the volunteer work of many members of our cadre, right? And this isn't paid work formally, and we'll talk more about like money and logistics later. Okay. Yes, thank you, Keegan. Yeah, if folks want to come in and like make some space, spoiler, you're gonna be talking to the people next to you, so get comfortable, you're gonna be chatting once I'm done rambling. So just feel free to like move around as you feel comfortable, as is possible. We want to get folks to come in and yeah, feel comfortable in here. Thanks, y'all. Okay, so one last bit on what is this session, right? So you can confirm whether or not the being here is worth it for you. What's valuable about Movement School to us is that it has made consistent and rigorous engagement with political education accessible for our comrades, especially those folks who are just entering the movement and beginning to think of themselves as revolutionaries and lifelong organizers. In this session, we're going to get to know each other a little bit, we're going to tell the story of Movement School, and then we're going to talk bluntly about some of the logistics and organizational requirements for a program of the scale that we ran. Unlike other sessions of this conference, this is not a political education session. We're not going to get to go into our curriculum. Maybe we can talk more about that in the Q&A session. But this is a skill share about developing a pretty robust political education program for your organizing community. And like I said before, this is not the political education program. This is a political education program. We hope that what we do contextually can help inform how y'all might or might not want to move forward with political education in your communities. And then I'm going to pass it over to Makarna and Michaela to talk about the history of this program and hopefully answer some of the points that folks brought up in terms of like how we got here, how we grew from about like 12 of us to a 50-plus member socialist cadre organization. And like cadre defined as, right, like we're a core group of like a movement of leaderful people, to steal the word from Left Roots, right, is that like there is hierarchy, no hierarchy, not in the sense of structurelessness, but structureful, like supporting each other, right? Everyone is empowered to lead projects develop the organization and amend our bylaws and get funding to do political projects, right? To us, that's what a cadre means, is that we are all equally empowered to step up and have access to the resources of our organization based on our commitment to it. I realize I should have defined that earlier because the idea of cadre is really core to what we do. But yes, yeah, so it was important for our development, and Mikhail's going to talk about the history of Movement School and how it's tied into the development of Red Pine.
Yeah. Hey, everybody. I'm really excited to be here. So my name is Michaela. I use she, her pronouns. I organize with Red Pine. I've been on the bottom liner team for the Movement School program in Red Pine since we started in like the fall of 2020. I'm going to talk a bit about the history of Movement School and sort of like how that interacts with Red Pine, our political home, and the ways that Movement School ends up affecting and changing Red Pine, and then vice versa in response to those changes. If you read Marx, it's like a dialectic or something, is what that's going to look like. So yeah, I'm going to talk also a lot about geography because what we do in our work is really hyper-local to Minnesota because that's where we are and that's where we feel we can have the most impact. So just like picture the state of Minnesota, right? It's kind of like a square with a big finger pointing up to the right towards Lake Superior. Right in the middle, there's Minneapolis and St. Paul. About an hour's drive south, there is the rural college town of Northfield, where a lot of stuff takes place in this history as well. And then to the north of that, like several hours drive north, there is a big rural area, lots of wetlands, and a lot of indigenous reservations where the Line 3 pipeline was built through those. And that's also really key to this story. I'm going to talk a lot about how the Line 3 pipeline and the movement to stop it sort of shaped who we are. So yeah, let's get to the story. So back in the fall of 2020, an org called Cooperation Northfield, which is the organization that will become Red Pine, which had at that point existed for a couple years and been like a small group of like 10 really dedicated cadre who all lived in Northfield, they are actively engaged in the movement to stop Line 3 that is being built in northern Minnesota. Right at this time is when construction on the pipeline is beginning, and there is ramping up a huge direct action campaign to stop that pipeline from being built that's being led by the indigenous people who live there. And so what they're doing, what their role in the movement is that they are organizing the base of people they have access to down in Northfield, which is primarily college climate organizers in Northfield and some as well in the Twin Cities. That's how me and Evelyn basically both got organized into being involved with Red Pine and the movement to stop Line 3. So they form a little org called Northfield Against Line 3, and through that and related channels like Minnesota 350, they're sending tons of them over time, especially ramping up in the summer of 2021, but starting way back in 2020 and earlier, they're sending tons of these college climate organizers up to live in the indigenous-led direct action camps, go out to fight the pipeline, and get arrested over and over again in the process. The thing is, these college kids, you know, I mean, if you've been around college environmentalists, most of them start out pretty liberal, but they are getting really rapidly radicalized through this experience of Line 3. Their relationship to the state and to its power has basically been turned upside down because now they're getting constantly brutalized by the cops to fight this pipeline. And also, the huge looming thing over this is that George Floyd just happened in our goddamn city. Like, this is just after the summer of 2020. Most of these people are going right from fighting the cops in the streets to fighting the cops up in the Northwoods. And so these organizers are becoming radical anarchists because of this. It's changing very quickly. But the thing is, there's not a lot of political education that's coming with this action. The action itself is really useful, but they are not developing much of a shared theory or strategic basis to their work that can get them past this fight to continue organizing for the rest of their lives. And plus, this shit is traumatic. Being beat up by cops sucks ass, as anybody else who's been beat up by cops in this room can say. And you can't just do that and accumulate charges forever. There has to be times of rest. So there is a specter haunting the movement to stop Line 3, and it's the specter of burnout. So while we're organizing in the movement to stop Line 3, Cooperation Northfield cadre, a few of them, start meeting with Overstory Alliance, which is a weird little environmental justice nonprofit started with an irresponsibly large grant from an eccentric billionaire that likes a former professor of theirs. That's how I originally came in. I got organized by Overstory Alliance people into doing, you know, real organizing. In the movement to stop Line 3. And so them and Cooperation Northfield have this shared idea of like, what if we start some kind of trade school of the future, this educational program that combines political education, sober and scary environmental analysis, and hard skills for living in a simpler society in the future. And particularly, Overstory Alliance was really interested in deep ecology, hard skills, and basically like, eco-vanguardism, like small groups of people disrupting society for the sake of the planet. While Cooperation Northfield was particularly interested in political education, building mass movements, and building up bases of popular power, but both were interested in each other's work overall enough to be able to work on that project together with each other. So as time goes on, the project trends more and more in the direction of political education, because the Cooperation Northfield people, they're already cadre organizers. They've been doing political education amongst themselves for years already, and they've gotten pretty good at delivering that. They have like a large shared library of political education that they can teach others. And me and the other college kids at OSA, like, we don't know how to actually teach trade skills. We don't know how to create a green vanguard. and so the trade school evolves into movement school, which is what the program is now. OSA was still really, really crucial to the project, though, because like I alluded to earlier, they have money. And Cooperation Northfield had none and never had any. They had been used to just being poor and got really good at organizing without money. Just in illustration, I'm going to talk more about money as the program goes on, and especially in like the takeaways section of the end. But just like to illustrate the difference that like having money could make versus just like not having money was that a longtime Cooperation Northfield cadre member, Cliff, who is one of the bottom liners of Movement School and who works on a worker co-op farm down in Northfield, he got a call from his cousin. The cousin told him, "Hey, I just drove past this decrepit, old-fashioned one-room schoolhouse on the side of the highway. And I think the guy who owns it is going to get it demolished or something. I know you guys like to do a bunch of weird stuff on your farm. Do you want it?" And so what he did is he used OSA money to pay to get it hauled to the farm. Then we renovated it, mostly laboring amongst ourselves to get that done. And most of that first movement school happened on the farm inside of the schoolhouse. It was a genuinely huge help. We still frequently use that schoolhouse to this day. It's really cool. This is the part where I wish we had a slideshow so we could show you pictures, but if you come talk to us afterward, we can find pictures. But it's on our shirts. So, yeah, thanks OSA, money helped. From the political education angle in particular, Movement School in 2021 was pursuing the goal of offering the scrappy Line 3 kids a political and strategic basis with which to continue organizing after the Line 3 fight is over. What we were trying to do was to prevent the burnout that could lead to these young organizers falling through the cracks, like happens so frequently. And so most of our participants that we were involving in Movement School are in our first iteration in the summer of 2021. We're staying on the front lines all summer and coming back once every few weeks for intensive weekend political education retreats back on the schoolhouse, on the farm in Northfield. But the thing about the Line 3 movement is it was very dynamic. Things were very rapidly changing, and we had to rapidly change course as needed for the schedule of the summer. Just to illustrate this point as well, we actually scrapped most of the schedule for our very first weekend retreat just the night before it happened, because we had to offer programming that was more responsive to the emotional needs of our participants. They had just been through a botched action that resulted in mass arrest and needed to know that there could be a light at the end of the tunnel. We had to switch things up a lot. In contrast to the people who were working and like living and getting beat up on the front lines, there was a much smaller crew of program participants who were lived in shared housing, paid for with that all-important OSA money down in Northfield, and they were engaging in the existing Northfield political projects that the cadre down there had built up over years, and doing what they could to support the front lines from afar, and frequently driving between the front lines and then going back to Northfield to take breaks. And Ev was one of the people who was in that first year of Movement School and living in one of the Northfield houses. I would love to hear you talk about your experience with that a little bit.
Yeah, I think one of the reflections here is that the first Movement School was chaotic and disorganized, and things were falling apart because we were fighting a pipeline. But I had a very unique experience among participants because Movement School paid for me to live in this tiny college town in a little blue house. And that was just a couple of folks, those of us who had, like, largely were folks who had, like, accrued charges during the winter. And we were all like, we have enough gross misdemeanor charges for now. Thank you. We're gonna like chill for a second. And so a bunch of us lived in that house doing mobilization work. We vetted people to go up and back to camp. And I mostly spent that summer like 6 hours a day just on the phone with random people, vetting them to come up to camp. And then in between that, right, I think a really valuable part of that program was just the intentional shared community of folks living in Northfield. And I was like a 5-minute walk away from the housing cooperative where most at the time Cooperation Northfield members were living. And I just kind of like walked in and I was like, I don't know you people that well. What's your fucking deal? And then they explained like cooperative living, right? And the like cooperative economy and the workers' co-ops that they worked on, right? And that kind of like accessible political education and intentional community was deeply valuable in the sense of like developing confidence in these people and me wanting to be their comrade, right? And we can talk about this more, but those of us who lived in Northfield gained trust with these folks who we didn't know that well. These people we met in passing on the front lines. And it caused us to really want to organize our friends to join this political community and do movement school the next year, right? And the program wouldn't have survived without, and continues to survive only because participants get their friends to join Red Pine and join movement school because they have folks, friends who are vaguely politicized and don't really have a political direction or a political home. And the fact that their friends are vouching and trusting in this political community makes them want to join, right? And just a takeaway is like, as a team of people who's maybe like pitching political education, on your own, you're never gonna get people to like stay, right? You can only chase people so much. Getting people to commit and be disciplined and attending 4 hours of political education twice a week for an entire summer is really hard. And they're only gonna do that if they're doing it with their friends and people they care about. So building spaces where folks are like, building deep, meaningful relationships as organizers and comrades and friends is how you sustain it. And I think if the movement school participants had just been folks coming back and forth from the front lines, we would have all been deeply distrustful of the folks who were continuing to stay in Northfield. And the fact that we were able to have conversations in the year after to like debrief all of that and build trust with each other and be like, no, actually those folks in Northfield are cool and they've done a lot of organizing over the past 10 years. We should work with them. That's a huge part of why Red Pine exists today. I think I'm kind of stepping on where you're going next. So I'll stop there.
No, totally. That just means fewer words that we have to say later. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that, Evelyn. And I'm really glad that that was able to happen. I think the complicating factor here is, and frankly, probably a failure of ours in Movement School 2021, is that not everyone was able to have such a cool experience. Like I said earlier, the vast majority of our participants were living full time on the Line 3 front lines in 2021. And tense relations with the frontline leaders because of the fact that they were like, wait a second, why are people leaving the front lines here in a way that we didn't realize? That was not communicated well enough with them, and we didn't realize that the lines of communication had broken down until it had already happened. And so that led to a lot of frontline participants just dropping off from the program over the summer because they were like, well, I care really deeply about this fight, and I don't want to hurt any of my relationships up here with the other organizers that I'm working with, so sorry, I'm going to have to stop coming to movement school. And that really sucked. I wish we would have anticipated that better, but it's a learning, and as we'll talk about more, like learning from the mistakes of previous years and to apply them to do better in future years is a really important part of how we do this, which is why I'm going to try to talk really frankly about our mistakes as well as our wins. So yeah, it was a bit chaotic. In that context, most of the Overstory Alliance team left the Movement School project after the 21 program ended to pursue other goals. But they did, at the very least, as sort of a show of faith, promise to fund a cheaper program next year. I, however, sort of, this was kind of the start of my split from Overstory Alliance. I remained and was slowly starting to fall more in line with the Cooperation Northfield crowd and the praxis they were doing instead. And yeah, Evelyn, do you want to talk about the activity thing?
Okay, so brief intermission. That's the end of year one of Movement School. We talked about it for a while because we want to set up the context, and then we're going to talk a little more briefly about the next 2 years after this. But we want to take a break and, again, ground in like the ability of y'all to develop your own political education programs as they exist or don't exist right now, which is why we're doing these little like pair shares with the people next to you. A thing that we're talking about in this theme of the era of movement school is that like a lot of our shared affinity as a political cadre comes from our shared analysis in why stopping the Line 3 tar sands oil pipeline was a thing worth doing and trying. And in your cadre or your political organizations, your political homes, or wherever you're coming from, or the kinds of political organizations you want to build in your communities, we feel it's important to like know where folks are coming from and what is the shared basis of like caring about the world being different that exists among the folks around you.
But yeah, okay. So thinking of history, where were we where we just left off? It was the end of summer 2021. The Line 3 pipeline just got built. And Movement School's first iteration ended. Amidst that, in the fall of 2021 and the following winter, a series of Cooperation Northfield retreats start happening for the old school Cooperation Northfield cadre who had been around for a while, and the much larger group of newly disillusioned, burnt out college organizers to meet up as one group, discuss their experiences and desires, and decide what road to take in the future. This is actually where Cooperation Northfield became Red Pine. They chose the name Red Pine Revolutionary Collective to sort of signal a shift in geographical intent from being just focused on the small town of Northfield to being more focused on Minnesota in general, where the red pine ancestrally grew all over the state. During those retreats, there is a lingering disillusionment among the college radicals. There's no clear path forward for them. They just got so many charges. They got their asses kicked over and over again. And it was like, okay, well, for what, you know, was the question. They learned a lot, but really kind of all they had left was shared trauma with their fellow organizers. And so then the question was, well, what are we going to do? What comes next? You might have guessed, it was another movement school. So we began to re-envision movement school for 2022 very early on. We started right after the end of 2021. So in like the fall of 2021, we're already thinking about this. And particularly, instead of focusing on providing political education to college kids who just got radicalized and are leftists now, we're working on actual organizing project incubation for these folks to work on them figuring out their strategy for these projects and offering accountability structures for them to create those projects in. Mostly the people who had participated in the program last year were then involved in the program again in the second year because the program had evolved to fit those needs. And that came off the back of a long, comprehensive series of meetings with movement elders, former participants, and other comrades in our network that we were accountable to. Especially with the many challenges I've talked about with the first year of movement school, we wanted to do our best to improve in the second year. And from those meetings, we all pretty much came to the conclusion that continuing a very local project-focused direction was the right way to go for the second iteration of movement school. That is when Evelyn joined the program in the second year, along with another bottom liner who was an alumni of the first year of the program. And the program was going to be shorter and cheaper. We had less money, we had less capacity in a shorter timeline than we had in 2021. So the 12-week program gets cut down to a 6-week program that does not get schoolhouse infrastructure anymore, but we're going to at least keep the lights on. And the thing was, it seemed like it was a really big success, is the crucial difference. Most participants, especially the disillusioned radicals, came away with a renewed sense of purpose and drive and ability to keep organizing in a very different context than the sort of shared background that they had with the Line 3 fight. So these driven movement school alumni are stepping powerfully back into local organizing, and they're eager to tell all of their friends and all their comrades about this awesome program that taught them so much. And so how did that reflect back on the sort of like newly formed Red Pine as an institution? The first thing that happened is in the fall of 2022, the projects that got started in that summer, Movement School of 2022, launched into the world as like proper organizing projects. And how successful were they? It was uneven in reality. The college organizing work that had already been going for a couple years before in Northfield took off and won big with a successful fossil fuel divestment campaign at Carleton College. The salting and worker organizing campaign in the Twin Cities started with a bang and tons of capacity, but it ran into several big hurdles. There were some people who started a union election at their job, and then their boss just closed the whole shop, and so now they're all unemployed. And so it lost a lot of capacity, but it is still going, and there are still people who are working in that. There was a program for people who wanted to form another housing co-op in the Twin Cities to save money and have control over their actual housing. That fell apart right after the summer ended. But most of the people who were in there are still friends with each other and talk about how much they want to live in a housing co-op. So maybe it'll come back, but there were some lessons to be learned from how the projects worked out. Red Pine continues to become more of an institution. We got bylaws in January 2023, so we finally had like a set of shared rules for how we wanted to operate together as a group of people. Some of the successful organizing projects, especially the college organizing, were funneling loads of new members into Red Pine, growing its membership pool rapidly at the same time as it was creating its first like real institutions outside of just loose friend groups. So, where did that leave Movement School next? I'm just gonna skip a little bit to try to give us some time. From the college and labor organizing in the Twin Cities, we were making new connections between Red Pine and groups of people we hadn't met before, and they were really interested in this Movement School thing that everybody was talking about, that their quote-unquote movement elders were talking about, which is the really ironic thing because these people who were their elders, who had maybe done Movement School the year before, were anywhere between 1 and 4 years older than these people they were now like recruiting into Movement School, but they looked up to them the way that I looked up to teenagers when I was 7. So I guess time moves fast in organizing. And as a result, that was the first year where we really didn't have to do much recruitment to get people into Movement School because our alumni were doing the recruiting for us from having a successful program the previous year. And so sort of our guiding question that we had in mind for Movement School this year in 2023 was we wanted to be more ambitious. We were thinking, okay, we just had a really successful program. What if we combine the best elements of the political education from 2021 with the project incubation from 2022 for a new generation of leftist organizers? And so we enacted that with a two-phase program. You can kind of see how that breaks down in the schedule on your handouts for folks who have handouts. If you don't have a handout, please look to your neighbors. Make sure to share with each other if you do. And so we had that two-phase program where the first phase is really focused on political education. The second phase is really focused on the project work. And throughout the program, there was much, much more significant involvement from Movement School alumni generally, as I kind of alluded to earlier. We had a new role for project leaders to sort of make the project work more supported in a way that would enable the projects to continue and be really fruitful for the people who were involved in them. And so our project leaders were all people who had done the program before. And they ended up taking on a lot of the session facilitation workload. They ended up being sort of the people who were communicating between the bottom liner team and the participants. And they were doing a ton of crucial logistics work, which was really, really useful for such a long program that we were doing. And it was awesome. I loved that. But yeah, so where we are right now is we are 8 days away from when Movement School just ended. Like, it literally just ended at the end of August. And we have just begun the process of starting to gather feedback from our participants, which is an incredibly crucial first step in like our planning cycle every year. Because we want to make sure that we're actually serving people's needs and making the program better. But the initial impressions are very good, with plenty of room to improve, which is a space I love to be in, because I'm excited to reinvent the program again and keep getting better at it. So that takes us to the present, right now. Before we transition to questions, we're going to talk about some takeaways and advice of like what we learned from building like a Movement School education program for our comrades, and maybe some things that you guys can take away for yourselves. I'll just start with the first one. The elephant in the room, the thing that we both love and hate to talk about, is money. I want to be really transparent about that. The movement school we made would not have been possible without money that was not locked behind institutional grants that we had no access to. It was from a tiny environmental justice nonprofit that our comrades had, who they got because their professor had a connection. It was hugely useful in terms of like actual numbers. In the first year, the program that we did was on a budget of like $30,000. The second year, it was down to like $15,000, and then it was back up to around $30,000 this year. And the thing you might notice with money like that is with things like towing schoolhouses, with having to like buy food for meals to be able to bring people to every session, because that's a really crucial thing we learned, is you can't get people to gather in person without food. It's so important. That is the main thing missing from this conference, to be honest. I'm glad we all feel the same about that. But with all that, it was not the kind of program that pays any kind of paycheck that could sustain you. We were able to have like occasionally stipends on like a need basis to both like participants and on the same basis to bottom liners who need it. Like, to give you an idea, I took a stipend of $1,500 from Movement School for this year. That's for an entire year of work. This is not something that's going to be a stable job, but we've really tried to prioritize investing that money in infrastructure when we can, and just, I don't know, really just getting work done when we can outside of that for our organizing. Yeah, even with no money, I feel confident that we could do a movement school. It would just suck more, and everybody involved would get poorer for it, because it wouldn't be able to be like, we are able to reimburse you for food and gas. It would be like, everybody bring an item. It's a potluck now. I'm sorry, we can't give you a stipend for like the work that you're missing. We just have to make do. Yeah, so that's like the main thing about money, is that it's like, it's complicated and that it really, really helps to have some, but we feel confident that we've been able to make do with less. We feel like we could be able to make do with even less. Like, we've already done some gaming out for next year of like, what if we get nothing? We're like, okay, we could make this work. So yeah, that's all about money.
Yeah.
You wanna talk?
Yeah, I'll add one thing to the money thing, is that like, to be really sober, right, like program on the scale that we have produced, which is not every program, right, but it, like, especially during the summer, is like 15 hours of labor a week at least from the bottom liners and a bunch of other folks, right, sometimes more than that. You probably will just be poor, right? I also received a $1,500 stipend for the program to be successful. I'm a full-time bartender. I went from working 5 days a week to 2 days a week. So I just made way less money. And that is just going to happen, right? Like, to carry out something like this without like it being your like nonprofit job. And it's great because you can do political education that is not accountable to people with shitty opinions. But, right, like, this is the problem with sustainable organizing that we try to work with all of our participants about, but also we're trying to figure out for ourselves, right? We just have to make sacrifices, right, and then end the summer with, like, really small bank accounts and get really nervous when you take a couple weeks off work to go to the socialism conference. And then you're like, oh, what's going to happen when I go back? okay, I'll shut up. Another reflection here is curriculum. The handouts that are in front of you are not what our curriculum arc looked like at the beginning of the summer. Every week we met, and the curriculum arc from week to week would change in response to participant needs and interest and how projects were developing. A reflection here is that you shouldn't be too attached to the political education that you're doing specifically. Don't go full loosey-goosey, right? There's a reason why you're trying to teach the things you're trying to teach. But also, we want to design curriculum with the needs of our comrades in mind. But you got to meet them where they're at, right? You got to meet folks where they're at for them to be engaged in your political education. Especially with guest speakers, it's really cool. We get a lot of cool movement elders from around Minneapolis to come talk to us. They're great people, but we have like no control over when these very busy people are going to come talk to us. We honestly don't even have control over like what they're going to talk about, right? We're going to ask them to talk about one thing, and then, you know, movement elders tend to move into different areas of wisdom that we didn't think they were going to talk about, which is great, and we learn a lot. But you've got to just go with it, right? And like, take the conclusions and the wisdom where you can get it. And be able to move around your content, right? And ideally, everyone in your like cadre and doing the education can do every session, so that when you move like this one political education session to like 2 weeks later, and it's like, oh no, actually Helen can't be there. Michaela, can you do it? Michaela can do it, right? Even though it's not Michaela's session, right? That's really important. And are you cool with me just moving to the very bottom thing here,
so we
move into... Okay, and then the last thing we'll do, I'm going to skip a couple we kind of already talked about, is that a continuing growth area for us is how do we teach our comrades and how do we teach ourselves to develop the discipline of being lifelong learners, right? And being perpetually curious about the theory and practice and reflection beyond our movement school program, right? We need our comrades. We all need to, as revolutionaries, be thinking, learning, and reflecting and acting beyond just when someone gets us in a room and gives us food and structures it, right? We can't win if we're only doing that. And the goal of our program is to move folks from the I show up when I am organized to learn versus I am learning every day and every moment of my life so that I will win. And that's a thing that we are learning for ourselves as organizers. We are not the most disciplined revolutionary organizers, and neither are participants. And we're all peers, and we're learning that together. But that's a larger existential challenge of our work. I'll try to work through these one by one. These are great questions. Thanks, y'all. Curriculum is always, for me, the most stressful part of planning the program. If you look on the back of your sheets, I should have called this out earlier, they're the last couple weeks, and then a rough timeline of the logistics of how we put the program together, by season, what kind of work we're doing. And you'll notice that curriculum is one of the last things that we do every year, which is deeply stressful, and I kind of hate it and wish we didn't do it that way. But also, it makes sense because it is responsive to our participants, right? We wait until we have a participant base and know what the projects are going to be before we set the curriculum arc, because we wanted to develop relevant skills for our participants. And as the programs have developed, right, Cliff and Helen, who are comrades who are a little older than us, right, started organizing high schoolers in Minneapolis 10 years ago, almost 10 years ago exactly. And so they had a lot of political education content that already existed. And as those of us joined Red Pine and kind of met them during the movement to Stop Line 3, right, we got acquainted with some of this political education content and we developed more together. And we kind of have this now library that kind of explains why we do the things we do in moving folks towards thinking as revolutionaries. And so part of it is that we already have the curriculum, right? We have a library in which we pull from. We go, this would be helpful. Helen, can you talk about this? Carly, can you talk about that? Can we get Ricardo to come and talk to us as a guest speaker about this, right? And then another part of it is that we go, oh shit, we need to talk about this. None of us have planned curriculum about that ever before. And we, every summer so far, we have been writing curriculum as the summer goes. It's usually we have a meeting the 2 weeks before a content session happens, and we talk about what curriculum needs to happen. And if it's not assigned, we go, Michaela, you're on that session. You have 2 weeks to plan it. And usually like Michaela or Rachel, right? Or me or Helen, right? We'll team up and then we work on it, right? And we're just building the track as we go. And then sometimes we go, actually, this isn't a good session. We're not doing a good job of writing it. And we change the schedule. The answer is that it's deeply chaotic, but also that means it's responsive to participant needs, right? And we can, Movement School 2022 was largely folks who had already done the first Movement School, and we wanted to do a 201 for those folks, right? And then this year we're starting fresh with folks who were mostly 18, 19, just had gotten to college and were excited about becoming political organizers, but didn't have the 101 political education that their peers did, right? So we were kind of moving it back, and we didn't know that was going to be our base in September. We only knew that in February, March. So that's kind of the curriculum question. Do you have any more on that?
Yeah, the question also about is curriculum built collectively? This last year, we were able to involve a lot of alumni from former years of Movement School in the process of building the curriculum, which felt really great. I loved hearing their feedback instead of just keeping it internal to the small bottom liner team. And we all collectively voted as the alumni grew plus the bottom liners about it. And in terms of involving the participants themselves in choosing the curriculum, we specifically chose a week. It's on the back of your sheet in week 9, participatory design, where we had the participants choose the content. So halfway through the program, we had a session, and we had been talking about this earlier to sort of prime their minds for this, but we had a session specifically where we were what do you guys want to see? What do you want to do during that week? And so we had some ideas where people were like, I want to do an organizing conversation one-to-one training. And we were like, cool, we'll have that. There were people who were like, hey, there's this dope movement artist named Ricardo Levins Morales who lives in town here. We want to hear from him. He's awesome. And so we were like, great, Ricardo, can you come? And he was gracious enough to say yes. So yeah, that was sort of in terms of like the collective nature of it. I'll move on to the next question about like vetting and...
Yeah, I have a clarification question about that for the comment. Are you asking about like vetting participants or like vetting folks who join the team or... yeah, it's like a Red Pine question. That's a great question. We are largely, again, a lot of our organizing is in response to the organizing, like... The genesis of a lot of our organizing, especially the movement Stop Line 3, which was a movement with some pretty like strict security culture, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of our peer organizations in Minneapolis, especially the like you know, Marxist-y, Maoist-y folks who we are friends with, but maybe aren't exactly ideologically aligned with, all love to them, right? Have some pretty strict guidelines for joining their group and have really strict requirements on political education in ways that we don't. You don't have to participate in movement school to be a member of Red Pine. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, like we're still developing our internal security culture. And what joining Red Pine looks like is, right, we know you as someone in the city of Minneapolis or St. Paul or Northfield, and you are engaging in some kind of organizing that aligns with the goals of the organizing we currently do. We have a couple of new member coordinators. They buy you coffee. They have a conversation. We have you sign up a little Google form that makes you a member, and then you're invited to all of our meetings. And then you have to pay dues. Dues can be $0, but it's just in the effort of like having a democratic group that like we fund ourselves. That's about it. And we are actively having meetings every month about our security culture and what it looks like to be a member and how we engage with that. But that's where we're at on that. And we're a pretty young group and we're still figuring it out, quite honestly.
Yeah. Maybe it'd be helpful. So I don't know if everyone's super familiar with the movement to Stop Line 3. Maybe just giving a quick explanation of that and why the vetting process was so important there.
Yeah. Should I?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. The movement to Stop Line 3 was a direct action movement against a tar sands oil pipeline built by the Enbridge International Corporation through Alberta, Canada, and northern Minnesota that is continuing to wreak ecological havoc on indigenous steward wetlands and reservations. It's fucked up, and we tried to stop it. And the movement, the direct action part of the movement, was largely led by indigenous frontline communities at action camps at undisclosed locations, and there was a lot of fear because of the Green Scare, which is history I can't like talk about right now so much because we don't have time. But there's this ongoing fear of infiltration and retaliation, and so we all used fake silly names. I don't know if that actually worked that well. I think our legal names were pretty easy to find out by the authorities because we kept getting arrested, and they got our IDs. But generally, right, like. I was genuinely, like, that summer on call 6 hours a day asking people really detailed questions to try to figure out if they were, like, infiltrators or not. And it was deeply paranoid, right? And a lot of us had really terrible experiences because there was this, like, constant culture of, like, don't fed jacket people, but also, right, if you're not, like, the most down you can be from a very specific angle, right, we don't totally trust you, right? And you have to do really deeply self-destructive things to be trusted in certain areas of the movement. And this is a very personal experience from very narrow aspects of that movement. But it was a reality, right? And it was the kind of thing where security culture led to a decreased capacity for the movement to do things. And a lot of us moved away with like, hey, that wasn't very democratic or really kept us safe. And yeah, I think there are people who were part of that movement who would call me an idiot for saying any of that. And there are a lot of like perspectives that don't feel that way, but that's where a lot of Red Pine folks walked away with in terms of security culture. So we want to be a public facing organization that like invites people in, right? So we just don't, if I don't know you very well, I'm not gonna talk to you about illegal shit. And that's fine. There are lots of members of Red Pine that I just don't have that relationship with, and that's cool, right? But that's part of how we, yeah, do vetting.
Yeah, I can speak to that last question from the comrade in the white mask about how the organization has evolved and what we have lost. I think a really big thing is right around the beginning, you know, before either of us were really members of Red Pine, is it was just a small core of like less than 10 people in Northfield, a small town, who mostly lived in a housing cooperative with each other. And through that, you know, everybody knew each other. Everybody was friends. They were able to organize with each other in the house, all in one place, like, and just communication lines were really easy to maintain. As Red Pine has grown so massively, we're now at over 50 members, the communication has to evolve with it. We have like new protocols for communication. There is like a huge Signal chat that all our members are in, which is not always the best place to communicate. The thing that we do is we try to be consistently meeting every month in like a shared location, like in person and on Zoom, in such a way that like we can talk to each other at those meetings. And the other thing is that like we are like continuously organizing with each other. So that is a way in which we are all frequently talking with each other. And also, like, frankly, like, a lot of us are just friends with each other. Part of the thing about that good old shared trauma that we all experience is that it's like, well, there's only a few people who understand that right now, so I'm going to talk to them about life. But yeah, I'm sure some of you know about that. But yeah, and in terms of like what has been lost, I think, you know, that sort of like immediacy that like a really small group can have has been lost to some degree. That's why we've like had to implement like democratic processes and like bylaws. We're in the beginning of creating a participatory budgeting process to actually use that dues money we've been raising and figure out where we can funnel that. And creating it is going to be a long road, but if it was a group of like just five people who lived together, it would be pretty easy to figure out how to use money. So yeah, I think the main thing is that things have to be slower and more intentional. And things often have to go through like mediated communication channels, like Signal chats, or like specifically set up meetings, rather than being like, oh, hey, I knock on your door at the co-op and I'm like, hey, we're talking about this. And then you say, cool.
So I'm not going to ask a question, but you can comment on what I say if you'd like. So this kind of reminds me, or takes me back to the Highlander School, the Freedom School is right. So, and just want to underline what you all mentioned was that, you know, theory does inform practice. And so when you looked at like that, those schools that they had, and I think it was formed in the 1930s, but what they would do is they had people come to these schools, and it was basically like nonviolent social justice work. Mm-hmm. So this is like pre-civil rights work. So actually Rosa Parks was sent to the Highlander School, and she was actually there. She was quite quiet when she attended, but she soaked it up like a sponge. And like, it's said that, you know, just the community that she was involved in, and it was really not, you know, anti-racist there. They had the whites cooking for them. It was like she never experienced anything like that. And also just to listen to other people in hardship in the movement and learn from them, and she got inspired. But she was actually still quite quiet, pretty quiet. But again, just the effect of that, like being in community with other people as you're learning, rather than just on your own with a book, like how informative that was. Because then later, it was only 5 months later, even though she was quiet, she took the act 5 months later and actually tied it back to, you know, getting inspired by Highlander, where she refused to get up her seat. And people actually point to that and say that was the instigation of the civil rights movement. So I don't take any of this work lightly. I think it's like hats off to you guys, because it's so important and really, really inspiring.
So thanks so much. Do you want to? Yeah, let's do Senya before we move on.
Did you?
Okay.
Well, come talk to us after. We'll
yeah,
be here.
We're going to be around.
You have time.
I want to kind of just move to the second question about curriculum and books, if that's cool.
Yeah, go ahead.
I thank you for all of those comments and sharing. We really don't read excerpts from books, and that was a big thing that annoyed me. I'm a big fan of books. I'm a big fan of reading and reading groups, right? I think it's, to me, the best way to learn, and it's very exciting. But we learned that most of our participants didn't like that. They were like, college students were very tired of being assigned things to read. And the only time we assigned something in the summer, you can see, we assigned a short article by Leftroots about building mass protagonism. We think it's a great article. I'm happy to share it with you if you, or you can just Google it and find it. It's really core to our theory of codification. We've adapted to folks being like, no, we actually don't respond well to that kind of learning. And so our model is based in popular education, which we can talk about for a really long time if anyone wants to grab a drink after this and talk about it. But we do a lot of like, not this. It's very rarely like, we are all on the same level. We're talking, there's like a whiteboard, we're drawing, we're asking questions, right? It's the kind of thing where like, as facilitators and educators, we need to have a deep understanding of the material that we are teaching, and then finding ways to organically communicate it to our participants, right? There is no, like, read this chapter of Marx as much as I unpopularly am like, let's all read this chapter of Marx. Instead, right, one of our activities that I really wish we could have like brought a whiteboard and just done as an example are these things called the political economy bubbles. And what it looks like, it's like, hey, what products have you used today? And someone says toothbrush and someone says car. And we like do that. And then we talk about like what made those products, right? Like plastic, like water. And then we go, and what else? And people say labor. We go, oh my God, labor. And we talk about like the political economy of how labor is a special thing that produces like commodities, right? And then we talk about the relationship about how labor is really important in producing those things, then we control the labor. And if we take away the hand that supports that bubble, it falls apart, right? And that's the kind of thing where like, we don't have to talk about Marx at all when we talk about that, when we do that session, right? And I like talking about Marx, and I think that like revolutionary organizers who call themselves Marxists should be able to explain Marxism. But in our introductory political education, right, we don't have to do that, right? And when folks come into political education spaces maybe bristling at being told a bunch of names of like dead Europeans, and they're like, no, 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 no. And it's like, totally, like we wanna like be empathetic and sympathetic to that. And so, right, and like these ideas aren't just Marx's, right? They come from a lot of different places, and we try to draw from a lot of different thinkers from a lot of different regions and times. But that's the kind of deal that we do, especially in our introductory political education. It's not like, read this chapter, it's like, what's the idea? Let's have a discussion about it. Yeah, that's my answer on curriculum. If we have any, we're at six. I don't know if we have any closing.
I don't think anything's happening in this time period, so I can just share a couple more thoughts.
Yeah, and then we can close formally.
Cool. Yeah, to the comrade in the gray hoodie who talked about Highlander School. Actually, one of our bottom liners, their name is Lenny Kane. They were maybe on your curriculum, your sort of schedule that you have with you here. They used to be an organizer in the South, and like they did work with Highlander School folks, and they're really cool, and they've been really influential on a lot of the theory that like we think of when we're like, okay, how do we do education?
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Philip. So yeah, that's no accident. We are definitely inspired by Highlander School. Yeah. And in terms of the idea of like people coming into our program and maybe not like immediately, obviously, like being like, okay, I'm going to act in all of these ways that are visible to Red Pine. Like a lot of people who come to movement school don't come to join Red Pine after, and that's fine. They don't need to. Like Red Pine is doing a Red Pine thing, and there are so many other formations that exist, even in our local area in the Twin Cities, in which people do really dope organizing. And I don't know, like, almost everybody, like, we find our way to connect with them. Like, I don't know, I've seen people when we were doing encampment defense a couple weeks ago, like, who I hadn't seen in forever, and I was like, oh my God, there you are, you know? Like, you've been operating in this sphere, and now we're coming together again. This is so awesome. Yeah, I just wanted to talk a little bit about that and how cool that is. And I think like the way that we have made movement school not like so strictly tightly tied to Red Pine of like you have to be a Red Pine member and you can't be a Red Pine member unless you do movement school. Keeping it a bit looser has enabled that, I think. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay. Do you have any other thoughts?
No, I think that's it for us formally. Thanks so much, everyone.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live.
And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.